Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Relay Bitcoin session. Today, it's a huge pleasure to have Giacomo Succo here as a very special guest. He's also a very early investor, actually, in Relay, so that's why I'm really looking forward to have this half an hour with him. We have some great questions prepared, but before, please, Giacomo, just introduce yourself very quickly for those who maybe don't know you.
Hi, everybody. I appreciate it very quickly because I can be very talkative. I'm Giacomo Succo. I am a Bitcoiner full-time since 2013. I created a few startups in the ecosystem, mostly research and development and education and consultancy. And right now I sold most of my companies and I'm mostly focusing as a teacher and in workshops and seminaries and consultant for Swiss banks mostly.
So you say full-time Bitcoiner, that leads kind of to my first question, like what led you to be this extreme? Like you're such an extreme, one of the most extreme Bitcoiners, full-on Bitcoin, you know, everything you think and work about is Bitcoin. Why?
Two reasons. The first is objective. Bitcoin is, in my opinion, very important. It's very consequential. It may not be literally true that if you fix the money, you fix the world, but it's approximately true. The money is a huge part of commerce and finance, and commerce and finance are a huge part of civilization, society, and geopolitics and everything. So money is seriously broken, both in the payment part and in the investment part and the saving part. So fixing that is consequential for the world. And then there is a subjective reason. Bitcoin is just at the intersection, at the overlap of many of the things I was interested with in my previous life before Bitcoin, but they were incompatible or anyway not really in harmony between among themselves. So I was interested in monetary theory. I was interested in the cypherpunk ideas. I was interested trying to make money for me and my family and having a job and investing and saving my money. And I was interested in technology and technological innovation. I was interested in science, conceptualization, system theories, computer theory a little bit, even if I was just a few years ago, I was a completely ignorant in serious computer theory. But I was interested in cryptography. So Bitcoin basically appeared as something that is the intersection of everything that I ever considered interesting, basically. Wow. And when I started to get involved in Bitcoin more, and even my wife was seriously involved, and then I started to make a lot of friends inside the ecosystem, basically it's like when you join a cult. Everything you do is inside that stuff, yeah. And there is no reason to go outside anymore. So I still talk with my family, but... I do think about other stuff which is not Bitcoin twice a day, let's say.
You need to force yourself.
Yeah.
Morning and evening,
yeah,
you think
keep
about
the routine. I have to, yeah. Even if I could find some link with Bitcoin.
Yeah, you can always, right? But that's so nice if you find this passion and you just always want to do just this. I mean, then that's when you made it, right?
Yeah.
Also in life, that's amazing.
It's not getting boring. There are so many faces, so many, the rabbit hole is so deep that it's very difficult to say, now I'm okay, I know everything, yeah. There is no mystery anymore. It doesn't happen.
So you focus on Bitcoin, you're a Bitcoin maximalist. What about other altcoins? Like one guy on Twitter asked, what's your favorite shitcoin and why?
So my favorite shitcoin is Zax Bucks. So you have to go on Zax Bucks, ZUXBUX.win, WIN. That is my favorite shitcoin. Nobody knows who created it. It appeared during my debate with Richard Hart, which is one of the many shitcoiners. And during the debate, I discovered that website and I presented it. And there are rumors about the creator, but nobody knows. And that's probably the best shitcoins because it's a zero knowledge coin. It means that you don't really know if you have it, if you don't, what it does. So it's complete zero knowledge technology. And it's also provably dishonest. I mean, it's a clear, honest Ponzi scheme. So you cannot get better than that.
It's really like as pointless as it gets.
Yeah.
Very cool. Back to Bitcoin, what's happening on like the privacy side and the latest developments in terms of privacy, and why do you think privacy on Bitcoin is so important?
So I answer to the last question first. I think that privacy on Bitcoin is important because the whole point of Bitcoin is to resist the confiscation and censorship. And in order to resist, and also resist manipulation, for example, monetary manipulation, in order to resist, the only weapon that we have is not right now physical force against the central bank, against a tax authority, against international sanctions. The only weapon is basically not being detectable and not being stopped and not be punished for what we did. So privacy is basically the number one weapon that allows Bitcoin to maintain its features. These features also include the monetary features. Some people think that as long as Bitcoin is disinflationary, that's the only feature that matters. But Bitcoin is disinflationary only because you run a node which respects the monetary policy, and you do just because the police is not entering your home to force you to run a node that will actually follow the ECB or the Federal Reserve Bitcoin policies. So the only reason that Bitcoin was not forced to follow monetary rules of the central banks are basically the reason that it's too expensive to go into every home and to force everybody to do differently, which is strictly related with privacy. And also privacy has a strong monetary, also commercial implication about fungibility. If any specific piece of Bitcoin is linked with an identity, then the cost of verification when you receive a payment diverges to infinity, because you have to know who is the guy paying you and who was the guy paying him. And so since you're not a bank and you don't have a legal license to launder money, then you have to basically be sure you feel and you are legally liable for everybody transacting before, which basically breaks the point of money. The point of money is that I pay you, you check this money, this is true, you don't even have to trust me anymore. No. So it breaks the utility of money as an instrument, as a tool. So privacy is very important. What's happening right now is that I think there are two sides of what's happening and what's going to happen. One side is the protocol innovation. Many people are excited about protocol innovation, but I want to take it aside for a minute, because I think that's not the low-hanging fruit. That's interesting. Let's go with that first, but it's not the priority in my opinion. Taproot will be interesting, mostly because it will make the soft fork, which is possibly happening next year. It will be interesting because it will basically make any transaction look similar, whether it is a script, a complex script, a multi-sig, or a single sig, or a Lightning channel opening, or a Lightning channel closing. So everything you do in a normal condition will basically look like a single signature. Then there will be something which is a privacy gain. It will reduce the wallet fingerprint and stuff. But this is not really a game changer. The game changer for privacy could be something called cross input signature aggregation. So right now, basically, the signature that we use in Bitcoin, you cannot add them up in order to create a valid signature. You can add up the private keys, and the signature of this sum of the private keys is the signature, the private key, which is the sum, is the private key of the sum of the public keys. But a CDSA is not linear in the signature, meaning that if you sum up the signatures, the sum is not a valid signature. With Schnorr, that will be introduced with Taproot, the signature is, you can add it up linearly. So it means that we can sign a document, I sign, you sign, and then we add up the signatures, and we just publish the sum of the signature and not the individual signatures. Mm-hmm. This is not included in Taproot. This will probably came later. I hope the sooner the better, because what it does is that basically it incentivizes people when they have to spend Bitcoin on chain to find the partners to sum the signature with, because the signature is the heaviest part of the transaction. So you save a lot of on-chain fees if you can share this block space with other mm-hmm. people. So the idea is that CoinJoin and PayJoin especially, so when you coordinate with other people to aggregate the inputs and the outputs, will especially become convenient in a situation in which we have signature aggregation, cross-input signature aggregation, and in which we also have high block space fees, which is likely going to happen anyway because of the dynamic of Bitcoin.
So it's a privacy gain and it's an efficiency gain.
It's an efficiency gain driving a privacy gain, which is very important because it gives people plausible deniability. If I ask a wallet developer, why did you put pay join as a feature. And the answer is, I mean, that's the only way the user will pay less. So we have to do that for fees. Yeah. So this is about the protocol. But I think that even if it's this very interesting, the point is that there are still so many low hanging fruits, which are not protocol, based protocol related, that are wallet related. I mean, until now, a lot of exchanges are basically allowing enforcing even single address reuse. Many tools for people receiving donation are using single address reuse. So linking forever their name with a specific address that everybody can see and follow. Wallets, many wallets don't allow you to do UTXO segregation and selection manually to separate your identities. They just merge everything together, so they make trivial to follow. CoinJoin tools are developing, but they can still go way better. Mm-hmm. Now there will be like Wabi Sabi experiment, there will be a CoinSwap, there will be PayJoin experiment, pay to endpoint. So there are a lot of stuff that we can do about privacy before even touching the protocol. Mm-hmm. And then a few things you can do with the protocol itself. So I think that we have to be very focused on low-hanging fruits on the user tool and best practices side. More than ever, we have to understand that privacy is important. Mm-hmm. If there is this meme, this myth that privacy in Bitcoin is not important as long as numbers go up, mm-hmm. Eventually this will fix itself because people will discover that privacy was important, but with a lot of suffering. While if we manage to get some awareness before, we can mitigate some of the learning pain to get there.
But you think in the next 5 to 10 years there will be a lot going on, a lot of improvements in privacy, obviously.
I'm certain, because one is one of the areas where there is more space for improvement, because wallets in the last years focus mostly on there is UX improvement, of course, because Bitcoin was nerd stuff. So in order to get normies interested, you need some UX improvement. But except for that, efficiency improvement, a lot of people got involved in efficiency improvement, cost saving improvement, feature improvement, a lot of feature creep. So I think that the area where people are probably focusing more right now is that, including inside the Lightning Network part, we will discuss this maybe later, but Lightning Network is interesting for privacy because on one side, it has no on-chain fingerprint except for the opening and the closure. So it's great for chain analysis because when you are on Lightning, you leave no chain analysis tract. And the existence of Lightning makes chain analysis less reliable because when you find a transaction, you don't know if it's a transaction between those parties or if they're just closing a channel that intermediated a lot of transactions you are not seeing. So it makes chain analysis less important in on-chain and off-chain. But there are Lightning is fragile to network analysis because now you have to be online and connect them peer to peer. Now you have an IP in the worst case or a Tor Onion address in the best case. But still, if you have a BTC pay server and you accept Lightning, your Lightning node, what is the address that they're using there? Is it your home IP? That's a serious privacy problem. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are trying now to find good solution like IP redirect and stuff like that, IP tutor and stuff like that, but it's not trivial. Mm-hmm. So there is a lot of privacy discussion to have about Lightning itself.
Yeah. And so even if we make like huge steps forward in the next 5 to 10 years in privacy, what happens, and that was one question from Twitter as well, what happens if governments just keep on criminalizing Bitcoin? And so imagine like most of the countries just basically criminalize and forbid the use and the holding of Bitcoin. What do you have in mind for that? Like, how can we prepare for that?
Well, I think that that's like a little bit like asking what happens if a gun needs to be actually used in a gunfight, or what happens if or even better, because Bitcoin is more defensive, what happens if a Kevlar vest needs to be used? Well, it happens that you have to use it and you have to hope it works for its purpose. So the point is that Bitcoin was created exactly to resist government censorship. Without that kind of objective, there is no point in something as complex and as inefficient as Bitcoin. Bitcoin is designed as it is because it has to survive government censorship. Not just survive, but Bitcoin is literally anti-fragile. That means that, for example, mining. mining tends to centralize because of obvious scale economies. So there are pooling pressures, and the miners will centralize around a few, I don't know, country energy vectors or ASICs producer. But if the government will start to censor and destroy mining farms, or regulate mining farms to a point which is not more convenient to run a mining farm, then this will create a pressure to decentralize. So in theory, Bitcoin is anti-fragility is a strange property because, or anti-fragility is a strange property because it depends. It's like if you have like if you are training an athlete, if you go too strong with the training, you will just kill him and he will not become a champion because it's dead. But if you are too soft, he will never become a champion because you never really pushed it. So he became soft, fat, lazy, and entitled. And so you need stress to train defensive weapons and to train defensive tools. You need some kind of attack, otherwise they become lazy. For example, before MTGOX was down, people were just concentrating 80% of the Bitcoin trading on one platform because, I mean, who cares? Mm-hmm. Then it goes down and now you learn, you suffer and you learn. Mm-hmm. Then people are maybe just, they all buy the same hardware wallet all the world because nothing can happen. And then the NSA maybe infiltrates the cheap producer and will just take out the Bitcoin of half of the world population. I'm exaggerating, but traumatic events will actually either kill Bitcoin or strengthen Bitcoin and make it more strong. What is the difference between killing or improving? The difference is how strong you, how much resilient you are already. So this is a matter of maturity. Like if the government attacked Bitcoin seriously in 2010, probably Bitcoin would not have survived. Mm-hmm. So maybe the idea would have survived, but re-bootstrapping that idea would not have been trivial. Like you have the idea of Bitcoin, but now the system is dead and the coin distribution is dead. How do you re-bootstrap it? How many people will try to re-bootstrap it independently? How do you coordinate that? So it would be, I'm not saying that if Bitcoin was killed, it will be impossible to re-bootstrap it, but it will probably be super slow, maybe not even in our lifetime. It will take a lot of coordination effort to re-bootstrap it. And also there will be like a disillusion because if it was killed once, how do I re-bootstrap it without getting it killed again? Mm. So Bitcoin survived the critical phase in which it was very fragile. And now it's in a phase in which I think is pretty much anti-fragile. But the only way to know is to test it. Mm. If the government never tries to make it illegal, people will just use it like PayPal, and then it will just become a less efficient version of PayPal. The only interesting point of Bitcoin is that it can do things that PayPal cannot for legal reasons. And so what about the illegal Bitcoin? What about illegal alcohol during the prohibition? Did it disappear? No, it just increased in price and you created speakeasies. What about the US dollars in the Soviet Union or in Venezuela? Does it disappear? No, it's the main money used in the black market. Everything in the black and gray market during the Soviet Union or in Venezuela is done in US dollars. It's not because it's legal, it's because it's illegal and because too many things are illegal. And I always like to say that everything you're doing today is illegal in some jurisdiction right now. Like if you're a woman and you're driving, that's illegal somewhere. If you're drinking alcohol, that's illegal. If you're reading some book, that's probably illegal somewhere. And if it's not, which is very unlikely, it was illegal at least once upon a time. So the point is not to ask nicely to the government to allow us to have a censorship resistant tool, but is to make sure it is really censorship resistant.
Yeah. And that's really the property that Bitcoin has, and that's why it has value, right? And it's very interesting metaphor that you say, because it's really, if it was at some point, the government can always criminalize, and they still can, but now the effect is not that big. It would have been big at some point, and then the consequence would have just been that Bitcoin dies. But just criminalizing as such is not a problem for Bitcoin, because it's certainly not now anymore, because now it's like a virus that spreads differently then, but it will still survive, right?
You cannot kill it.
The virus is too, you cannot, I mean, if the virus is very low with like only 10 to 15 people, you can still, you know,
kill
control it. that at one point...
And that's a good metaphor. Yeah. Governments cannot stop viruses.
As we see.
Politicians cannot stop viruses.
Interesting. And so maybe just to make a little different thing, because you're so deep in the Bitcoin, you know, network, you go to a lot of conferences, you basically know every Bitcoin company in the world. That's why probably some people on Twitter ask you for some tips if they look for job opportunities, especially like in the last 2 to 4 months. We actually had quite some applications, you know, initiative applications. We're not actively looking for people, but they ask us like, cool Bitcoin company, how can I work for you? And like, I feel there's more and more a trend of traditional people who have great skills, who have great experience, who have good drive, that want to come into the Bitcoin space and work. So what would you advise them how to go for like job opportunities, job search?
So first, let me link this question with the previous. I say that government prohibition, widespread government prohibition will not damage Bitcoin, will just strengthen it, which is true, but it will certainly kill a lot of Bitcoin related jobs and enterprises. Yeah. So that's something that I forgot to say. If you have a prohibition, then like Relay or my research company, that will be a problem. So not a problem for Bitcoin, but a problem for clear, formally established companies
for the ecosystem,
especially for the legal part of the ecosystem, for the legal entities basically.
Yeah.
And so assuming that we are talking about like Switzerland and other places where business on Bitcoin is easy or anyway easy enough to do, then the problem becomes that first, it's not easy to make money on Bitcoin in a legit way in the first place. The business model in Bitcoin that are honest and sustainable and scalable are very, very few. For example, I've been in education and consultancy for a while. That's completely sustainable. I can live with it. I can just pay my bills, but it's not scalable or not trivially scalable. Mm. An exchange, making money out of financial services, which can be matching demand and offer or escrowing fiat, like an exchange or doing custody, like most exchanges, or lending maybe in some cases, or payment processing, even like Relay as an app, in a way is basically taking exchange fees. So that's a sustainable and scalable business model, which is very challenging from the legal point of view for the fiat part. But from the Bitcoin part, it's pretty established. And then there are a few other business models actually, which makes sense. Hardware, because hardware is not open source, it's difficult to copy. And maybe you, and a very few others. So the point is that in this kind of business cases, the kind of jobs are basically, that I see are two. One is developers. If you are a developer, then there is a lot of stuff to do in Bitcoin. Mm. You can create better exchanges with proofs of reserves. You can innovate a lot with Lightning deposit, Lightning withdrawal, better privacy. You can do a lot of stuff in exchanges. If you work in hardware, you can create an hardware node, an hardware wallet, an hardware mining ASICs. Of course, ASICs are very capital intensive, but still, if you are an engineer in that field, you can maybe do something about that. If you are in an exchange point of view, also if you are a legal expert, you can actually make a lot of stuff. People who can navigate across regulation can help, especially the very financial. Important. It's very important. So a lot of people that are not developers, I mean, it's still about being hackers, but you don't have to hack the machine. You have to hack the social machine. Yeah. So you have to hack the system and in a sustainable way. The difference that for a computer hacker, when you create a system that works, it will likely works for a while. While in the social ecosystem, when you create a legal hack, the regulator will just change the laws in order to. So it's more like catch me if you can game. You have to keep running, which is stressful. Mm-hmm. It's not something I want to do, but a lot of good people can actually do that. Yeah, you have to be the sole good man of Bitcoin, a good Bitcoin lawyer.
Okay, yeah, that's I think that's also the two most important fields now to suck talent into the ecosystem so that we can grow.
Yeah.
But what about...
To be clear, a lot of people will think that they want to do podcasts or journalists or a PR or marketing guys. That's fine. What you can succeed with that. What I'm saying is that probably the supply of that kind of skills are overwhelming compared to the demand. A lot of people won't do the UX expert because there are soft skills where everybody feels competent enough to try. Mm-hmm. So everybody wants to do a Bitcoin event organizer. Fine. I think that could be sustainable for your life and maybe a good way to stay inside Bitcoin, in the Bitcoin revolution, paying the bills. But I'm skeptical that most of people will manage to become a Bitcoin event organizer, journalist, podcaster, or in a sustainable way. You do it because you like it, but the business, the scalable business, is probably something else.
Yeah. But still, I think if you have a skill that was kind of in the old world of value, then you can, there's always ways to translate this skill and add value for people or organizations now in this new ecosystem. I really would like to make people hope that, you know, reach out to these companies. I mean, Bitcoin companies are always, you know, usually very, very, you know, open-minded and trying to find ways how they can employ these skills. And, you know, as long as you add value to something, then you, and you're motivated to add value to the Bitcoin ecosystem, then there will be
a chance, absolutely. And care for your reputation, cultivate your reputation, because there will be a bull run at a certain point. There will be another crazy price dynamics. So there will be a lot of new waves of scams and shitcoins and ICOs. If you are developers, maybe you can even do an ICO and still be hired but for example, if you are an advisor, a public figure, and you link your name with a lot of projects that fails and shitcoins will fail, then that could become problematic. Yeah. So don't waste away your reputation for the first easy money grab, because that will make harder to clean your reputation.
That's
after.
Very, very crucial, I think. Yeah, absolutely. So what is your like big vision looking, you know, into the future, 5, 10, maybe even 20 years for Bitcoin? And in the same way, do you see any kind of hurdles that we need, that will be critical, that we need to jump over and then could actually stop Bitcoin still?
Yeah, I think that Bitcoin will, I really like the distinction between the function of money as a store of value and the function of money as medium of exchange. There have been a lot of debate about that. But I think that even if we spoke about that a lot, there's still a lot of, there's still not a lot of clarity about that. So I think that in the next years, the things that we'll see will be the dominant dynamic will be the consolidation of the store of value, the permissionless store of value use case, which means a lot of people that cannot store value in traditional ways, they will actually use Bitcoin. So a family without KYC in Africa, a family in Venezuela, a family exporting wealth from China, a guy that just doesn't want to be confiscated or spied upon, who wants privacy, or a guy that wants to protect from inflation, but he cannot access the stock market easily. So the small guy, so we're talking about small savings, but with a cumulative effect of everybody in the world having an access to this, while very few people have access to normal saving tools. So Bitcoin is a killer saving app, but not everybody can enter the alternatives, the legal, the fiat competition. So this phase, I think, will be dominant for a few years. Mm-hmm. Then I think we will have a dominant phase in which since these small savings accumulated and compounded created a huge huge demand pressure, then even traditional investors that can invest in normal stuff, like a Swiss investor, an American investor, they will actually start to allocate, because the Bitcoin will prove to be an asset which is non-correlated with other kind of asset classes, which is already true now, but it will be even more evident in the future. So the normie investor, the boomer investor, the traditional investor will also use that as a store of value, because they will see the debasement of the dollar, the eventual crash of the stock market, and that will be a safe haven. We are seeing that already. Like, we see a few companies putting a percentage of their cash reserve in Bitcoin. We see a lot of Swiss banks allowing their clients to save something in Bitcoin or to invest. Saving and investment are not synonymous, but let's just not get into that right now. So this is already possible now, but will probably become dominant mm-hmm. in a few years. Then there will be a phase of medium of exchange. I think that the medium of exchange to be really used needs to be a store of value first. So there will be permissionless exchange, mostly over the internet. I think that face-to-face will probably use other tools, maybe some kind of very devaluated fiat, maybe some kind of physical gold, but you don't really need Bitcoin face to face. It will be probably the last thing to happen at scale. Somebody can still use it face to face today, but it's mostly flexing, it's mostly showing up. It's not really about a better competitor than mm-hmm. fiat. If you are a guy in Venezuela, you have to buy something, just use US dollars. It's just as illegal as Bitcoin, but it's more practical for face to face. But over the internet, the e-commerce can expand to everybody only if you use Bitcoin. The e-commerce, the fiat e-commerce cannot go beyond the KYC bubble, cannot go beyond the privilege of a very close self-referential system that is not expanding, but is actually tightening, is actually increasing the regulation, the friction, the controls. So the fiat world is actually is a cage that is actually compressing, and the e-commerce outside that is expanding, but we will need a lot of time to see that scale, I think, because, for example, you can do e-commerce freely in Africa right now, but maybe your internet infrastructure sucks and you don't know how to ship the goods because you can receive Bitcoin, but you don't have an easy way to ship the goods if you don't have infrastructure. So it will take time. And also, when the saving use case is so important, it disrupts a little bit the spending use case. It's happening. For example, already now you can spend Bitcoin for everything you cannot use fiat for. If you have to do, for example, you want to buy a VPN online, but you want privacy, well, Bitcoin is the only way. You cannot do it with fiat. You need Bitcoin to buy a VPN with privacy, or a burner SIM or whatever, or the anonymous domain. So for those very niche use cases, it's still going strong, but it's already going strong. But it will probably become a phenomenal scale in a few years. And then the last one, I think, will be the medium of exchange just for normal transactions. It will happen just for network effects. Since a great part of the world is the great economy, and since the great economy, especially over the internet, will move to Bitcoin eventually in almost a complete way, then also the white and face-to-face economy that don't need Bitcoin, strictly speaking, right now, will follow just because open standards tend to be gravitational singularities. Like, you have the internet. Imagine you have a company in 1995. You need an internal information system for your company. You don't use the internet, you use the mainframe. But then, because it centralizes better for your use case. But then if you have to do the same thing in 2015, even if you are centralized, use the internet just because everybody else is. So you reuse the tools, the libraries, the software, the skills, the user habits, just because of network effects, just because of standardness. So standardness will probably be the last thing. And each of this stuff can be, especially the last one, can be stopped maybe by political action, while the first one can only be slowed down. Yeah. Institutional saving can be stopped by governments, while permissionless saving cannot. White market exchange can be stopped by governments, while black and gray market exchange, by definition, cannot. So the phase two and four are possible to be stopped or delayed indefinitely, while phase one and three are actually just happening as long as Bitcoin works.
Interesting, very interesting. Never thought about that like this way, but then still it adds up to the fact that it's not stoppable. And on some in some cases, on some areas, it might be stoppable or at least delayable, but
yeah,
it will always find a way through other use cases and niches and stuff.
That's the thesis. If we are not wrong. And I try to imagine this in a scenario of failure of Bitcoin as getting harder and harder every year.
Yeah, but every day that it survives, it gets harder, right? That's a common thing. Cool. Let's get into some technical questions. There are two technical questions that have been asked by our Twitter community. And one is, can you explain and talk about a little bit about RGB and NFT, like what the difference are and why do you think RGB is superior to NFT? So maybe explain the two things, what they are.
So RGB is a proposal for a protocol, a set of protocols, actually a set of standards for the way to create generic tokens on reusing part of the Bitcoin infrastructure and an idea in a decentralized way. So it's not about the use that you do with it. So an NFT, like a non-fungible token, can be done with an Ethereum token, a Tron token, or one of these shitcoin tokens, or it can be done with a Google spreadsheet, or it can be done with RGB. So the main difference is the architecture, and I think that the RGB is superior because I personally I really like the design. The design of RGB comes from an idea of some discussions back in 2018 with Peter Todd, and Peter Todd had this idea of client-side validation. Basically said the global consensus of Bitcoin, the time chain with the blocks connected with everybody, has to check everybody's transaction, validate everything. This is great for anti-double spending, but this is not needed for validation. You need this kind of proof of publication mechanism, which is the time chain, is a proof that something happened and the opposite did not happen. So it's like a single use seal closing, but it's not necessary that you also ask everybody to validate everything. You should just validate in theory. It would be more efficient if you could receive directly peer-to-peer the transaction content, the transaction data, validate it on your node, and then just check in the global consensus against double spending of that same data. So the idea is that you pay me, you give me the signature, and you commit to the signature inside the Bitcoin block. I check the block, I know it's not double spended, and then I have to spend again. I will pass your signature plus my signature with a growing chain of signature. But even if it's growing, it's okay because not global consensus, so we don't have the same trade-off of big blocks. We can have 3 megabytes of signatures passing it around peer-to-peer without problem. So this idea is an idea that Peter proposed for Bitcoin itself, but for Bitcoin itself, it would be pretty hard to even conceive and make it work. So the idea is, if we want to do generic tokens, why do we have to recreate the problem of global consensus, which are even worse? For example, Counterparty, Omni, ERC20, they are as bad as Bitcoin, but worse, because, for example, scalability, it's even worse when you have a token, because the miners cannot check the rules of Counterparty or Omni, so you cannot do a lightweight node or another wallet in a trivial way. And you cannot put it on Lightning in a trivial way. You cannot, as privacy is worse, because you have the same traceability of the time chain, but you also have a smaller anonymity set because nobody's moving around that token. So privacy is even worse for tokens than for Bitcoin. So everything which is bad with Bitcoin on chain is worse for tokens. Mm-hmm. So the idea of RGB is to change the dynamic and to only use Bitcoin as an anti-double spending layer without polluting the UTXO or the time chain and the block space, because we just use a pay to contract or send to contract. Basically, we do commitment without using any block space. We don't use operators or stuff. So, and everything else is transfer peer to peer. Using Lightning, the fact that the Lightning network already needs a peer-to-peer transmission layer, because I already have to send you the channel update, and you already have to store all the channel updates. So there is, in Lightning, there already are people that are transmitting and routing and storing off-chain information. So we leverage this infrastructure to use the token information inside the Lightning network and the chain, the time chain, only for anti-double spending. That said, NFT are just a use case. I'm skeptical about the disruptivity of this use case. I think that some digital collectibles could be fine. So it's if you want to do rare papers or CryptoKitties, that's probably a market that can survive. It's the market of collectibles in a digital version. If it works for paper, like comics in limited edition, you can photocopy a comic, but nobody does that because the collection is the collection. You want the original. So if you have the same stuff in digital, I think it can work. It's not disruptive. It's not the next big thing. I mean, we're talking about Bitcoin, which is the revolution of the history of money and all the consequences, and something for collectors, which is fine, but not not nearly as interesting or important.
So you think there are no other use cases that are interesting? For example, on the Ethereum blockchain, you have all these utility tokens, you have a lot of tokenization of real assets, and this could technically, as if I understand correctly, could technically be done with RGB in a better way.
Yeah.
But you don't think that this is even something that, well, I mean, it will obviously probably happen if it's possible that people will experiment, but you don't think this is going to be an interesting thing sustainably?
I'm not bullish on many of these use cases. I think that if I see some stupid token on RGB, at least the architecture is better. So I'm happy for the architecture, but the economic sense is, if it doesn't make sense, it still doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. Like utility token don't make any sense. I think that collectibles make some sense. Then you can have maybe some legal arbiters too, like USD Tether is a very interesting thing, because USD Tether is a tool for a unregulatable secondary market. You have to KYC to buy Tether and to sell Tether to Tether company, but then in the secondary market you can actually trade freely, and that could be a nice way to onboard people on Bitcoin around the restrictions. But in order to do that, you need a huge privacy, and you don't have that on ERC20, you don't have that on Omni, while you may have that on Liquid, and you may have that on RGB. So Tether could be another nice application.
Which is basically tokenized USD.
It's just a tokenized IOU. And similar IOUs can be used, but for example, I'm a company that is issuing an equity. I cannot trade freely this equity, but the secondary market can, and it's not my responsibility because I'm just using an open. So it's basically legal plausible deniability. It would be better, technologically speaking, to just use a spreadsheet or a MySQL in the server of the company. Since, I mean, if Microsoft is issuing shares on top of RGB, why isn't Microsoft just issuing share on Microsoft server? Because they have a server, and it's centralized anyway. Yep. So separating the redeeming, the promise redeeming from the ownership could be interesting, in my opinion, to go around some regulation, but only for that.
Okay.
And then again, like I said about Bitcoin, in a distant future where everybody is using Bitcoin already for other reasons, maybe even if you have not a specific reason to issue on RGB, you do just because of network effects. Yep. So if everybody's already using the Bitcoin software, the Bitcoin code base, the Bitcoin tools, the Bitcoin hardware, the Bitcoin wallets, then and the Bitcoin libraries and standards, then you have to issue a share. Maybe in 2057, you go with RGB just because you want to reuse the same practices and the same tools, not because you need RGB.
Because you want to be on the strongest chain in terms of network effects, in terms of
standards and languages and code bases
security,
and practices.
Because there's most hash rate.
Yeah, even security. Security maybe, because the point is that double spending is a problem. But when you have an IOU, the main problem is that the issuer will not actually honor the IOU. So you have a worse security problem than double spending.
But at least not on the protocol. What you tokenize and trade, then this is obviously a whole other game field. Okay, you touched on Lightning as like, because we're now kind of talking about second layer stuff. You talked about Lightning, and so one question was, will Lightning solve Bitcoin's scalability issues? Like in terms of, because now the network again is quite congested, you know, it takes a long time until transactions clear and it's quite expensive. So will Lightning solve that? And what's the game theory behind Lightning and maybe also other second layer solution? Because, you know, you can transact on the Lightning network for like a fraction of a cent, but nobody who's like that, there need to be nodes who are routing these payments, which they basically don't earn anything. So right now for me, I'm also a little bit skeptical about like the game theory and the economics behind it. So could you elaborate a little bit on that? Like, will Lightning solve Bitcoin scalability issues? And then second, how can it be sustainable in like from a game theory and economic point of view?
Yeah, so first of all, I don't think that Bitcoin as an asset, as a monetary abstract object, has any scalability issue itself. Is the blockchain, is the Bitcoin layer, it is the Bitcoin network that has a scalability problem, not the asset itself. So Al Finney already in 2011 said there is not really a problem. Bitcoin will not scale as a network, as a computer network, to move stuff in, on chain, because that will never scale. But we will just have people issuing Bitcoin IOUs, which will be trusted, so bad, but it can be permissionless, a permissionless competition of like informal Bitcoin banks, which could create the scalability. So in theory, I think that Bitcoin will scale eventually anyway, even if the only thing that you can do in a trustless way is the settlement. So even if the settlement is not scalable, big entities, anonymous, pseudonymous, permissionless, that does the settlement are probably enough to have everybody using Bitcoin on some kind of conceptual credit layer. But when Lightning came along, we could, this is still valid, but we could also do better. So with Lightning, you can have a scalability down to the small payment, even without trusting anybody, without involving trusted third party that are always a security hole. So the idea is that Bitcoin can probably scale even just with a trust-based system on top of a trustless system. But with Lightning, probably you don't even need that much the trusted system on top. So that's beautiful. Lightning doesn't solve scalability. Lightning plus Bitcoin solve together or mitigate together scalability problem in with some kind of complementarity. I said before that, for example, Lightning is great for privacy because nothing leaves traces on chain analysis layer, but it's bad for network, for example, because you have to be connected. While Bitcoin is great for network privacy because you just broadcast and you don't know where stuff is going, everybody's relaying. Lightning is bad for privacy network, for network privacy. The same goes for scalability. Like Bitcoin is very bad at divisibility because if you send 1 cent, you will spend more for fees than for the payment. So a base layer of Bitcoin is bad for divisibility, while Lightning is great for divisibility because you can send even fraction of satoshis in theory, even if you cannot settle them, but you can go very, very low with divisibility. But Lightning is very bad for portability, because if you want to send $1 million to Lightning, as you said, the problem that you expressed is true, but it's even more true when you have to pay big sums. If you want to pay €1, you will find a route easily. If you want to pay €50, you will possibly find a route with a few failure and spending it, and that's where the game theory will come about. Right now, nodes, Lightning is at the beginning, so if you are a node operator or router, you probably just put a fixed fee and you don't care. But eventually when the system, just like in Bitcoin, the first miner, they didn't care about the fees. They just were getting zero fee transaction and they were getting, didn't have complex. There was not a competition. So they were not maximizing the fees. When there will be a healthy competition about off-chain transaction and routing, then router will start to maximize the fees for liquidity. So the more you pay, the more you are renting my liquidity, so the more I will, it will be probably a percentage of the, it's already are in some implementation. And also it will be a function of balance. If I have a perfectly balanced channel and your transaction is going to get me to get me out of balance, I will ask you to pay more for the more you use my channel. Mm-hmm. The other way around, I will maybe ask you very less, because if I'm unbalanced, but your routing will rebalance me, I will give you a super discount because in this case you are helping me to rebalance. Mm-hmm. So there would be probably an ecosystem that would be, but in order to see that developing, we need incentives, as you said. So we need strong, high fees on chain, otherwise nobody needs that. And we need a lot of competition of routing nodes that will try to make money out of the competition.
So there will be a fee market created on the Lightning Network exactly as it is on the Bitcoin Network, yeah, but just on a way lower scale, because also
on a different scale. It will be basically, as I said, divisibility versus portability. The base layer will be great for huge payments and slow payments, and the network, the Lightning Network will be great for small payments, but not for great payments. Like every time when you have to send $1 million, even if the Lightning network could sustain that, the fee will be so huge that you will never send $1 million on Lightning. You will always go on chain. So I think that alone, the Lightning Network is great for divisibility, but bad for portability. The base layer is the other way around. Together, the market will just distribute over two alternatives and they will balance each other.
Perfect complement, right?
It's a perfect complement.
Very, very cool. That's very interesting. Really, really nice insights. So two last fast questions and sure, then we need to go. What's the next thing you are going to identify as?
Oh, so looking at the current political situation, I think I will have to identify as healthy, because it would be the only way I could go around and enter places and take planes. And so I would probably identify as immune to pandemics and stuff like that. I mean, it would be a microaggression to deny my self-identification. So I hope that people will be sensitive enough and tolerant enough to grant me this right to self-identify.
What's the story behind you identifying as different things?
I think it started about a panel, Bitcoin panel, and it was like a panel of just women, and somebody was, I don't remember even what it was, but he was a male, a guy, and he was arguing that you have to do an all female panel, but also that people should be free to self-identify as female or not, which, I mean, I don't have issue with. You can identify what you want, but I have issue with logical inconsistency. If you go for self-identification, which is fine by me, you can identify as an airplane, for what I care. But then to do a panel based on the genitals of the people on the stage could be more problematic, right? It's just like saying you don't have to talk about people's nationality, but now we do a panel of only Italian people. I mean, one of the two, you have to decide. So I say that as a joke, I identify as seven women. So not only I am in the panel, but I am all the panel because I'm identified as seven. Then I put a racial thing because I also find, clustering people based on the degree of melanin in the skin is crazy for me, but it's crazy both ways. I'm not interested in a panel of people with a higher concentration of melanin or with a lower concentration. The skin level of melanin in your skin for me is interesting in two ways. When you go to the beach, you have to put less sunscreen if you have a higher melanin. And then if you are maybe doing a film about some population in Africa and you use actors with too low melanin, that's not realistic. Those are the only two cases in which I even care about the concentration of melanin in other people's skin. So, but people are sensitive about this stuff, especially Americans. So I like to trigger them and to try to get them thinking a little bit.
I think you're doing a good job there. Okay, last but not least, how much of your total funds do you hold in Bitcoin?
So, you know, there was this, I like going around in boats, and there was this tragic accident. So right now it's unfortunately zero. I did have a last part of Bitcoin. I just have the last few coins, and I use them all to invest in Relay. Absolutely zero.
And you had to even, you invested it in Bitcoin, but we had even to
change it to fiat. And it was really so humiliating. So I have zero wealth. I just have a few thousands of francs on my bank accounts, and that's all I have because boats are dangerous. That's all.
It's crazy. I kind of keeping hearing those boat accident things with a lot. It happens to a lot of Bitcoin. Like Bitcoin seem to really attract these dangerous situations on boats.
Yeah, that's worse than the pandemics. That's a real risk. that's a real global risk that we're suffering. Stay safe, guys. Stay out of the boats.
On those waters. Thank you very, very much, Giacomo, for
my pleasure.
On. I wish you all the best and hope to have you on soon again. Take care.
Thanks.
Cheers. Thank you.